The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A lot to get to on today's program, as per usual. A little bit of an update first here on the Houston public appearance campaign, my father's speaking campaign there in South Texas, Sunday night. And then again last night, the first night, I'm told that there were about 135 in attendance, and a little over half that the second night, so not quite as many people as we had in Southern California, but a good group, a small group of people that have signed up for the follow-up Bible study in the weeks ahead. So again, a lot to be praying for, just as my father brought out in the most recent coworker letter, in which he advertised the new Ruth booklet and also admonished us to be praying for the success of these campaigns. A little bit of Edstone news as well. I mentioned Isaac McDonald dancing yesterday at All Ireland's. He came in fourth at one of the biggest dance competitions in the world, second, I guess, only to the World Championships. And his father, Brad McDonald, tells me that I think everyone was there in his age group except maybe one out of the top tier. So pretty much he's fourth in the world, you could say. Pretty amazing result from yesterday for young Isaac. I think he's, what, 11, 12? I forget how old he is. He's young, but he's growing fast, as are all of our children. Well, today I'm going to focus primarily on the moral breakdown in the United States and Britain, or the new American morality, as Joel Hilliker called it in an article he wrote a few weeks back. You'll see, again, there's just some... It's things we have to comment on, and it just seems like these headlines and these subjects, these topics that are discussed now, are just becoming more and more crazy and bizarre. They just have you shaking your head all the way through, and yet there's obviously a lot of people that are really latching on to these new ideas, these new morals, as they're being defined by those leading the nations. First, though, I just want to make a few comments here on the new White House budget, the budget buster, as I've been calling it. One thing we know about the years ahead, there will be a lot of spending. The title of the Trump administration's budget is perfect, an American budget. It certainly is an American budget. Lots of spending, lots of debt. Lots of spending on things you can't afford. That's the American way. This is definitely an American budget. That's for sure. The New York Times said this morning the White House proposes $4.4 trillion budget that adds $7 trillion to the deficits. I've written on these annual budgets quite a bit over the years, but it wasn't that long ago when we were talking about a $3.1 trillion budget. I mean, it's up to $4.4 trillion. That's insane that we have that much spending and we have so little to show for it. And we have to go into so much debt to keep adding these new programs, infrastructure and the like. $4.4 trillion. Came out yesterday, the Times says, outlining steep cuts to domestic programs. This is the Times, of course. They want to see more spending, just more on domestic programs. It says there's large increases in military spending and a ballooning federal deficit that illustrates how far Republicans have strayed from their longtime embrace of balanced budgets. Well, the Times is right on that. It used to be, not that long ago, the Republicans were the ones that wanted to get the budget balanced. Later on in the piece, it says Mr. Trump, who's a businessman, once called himself the king of debt, has overseen a federal spending spree that will earn him the title in an entirely different arena. That's what this is, a federal spending spree, and there's no limit on it. It just keeps on going. It keeps on growing. The White House plan would add $7 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. That's right up there on the Obama level. No difference. You watch. I mean, in the end, he's going to end up outspending President Obama. Right now, he's on pace with that first year from Obama when, I mean, Obama was coming out of that crash in 2008. Nothing like that this time around. No significant military action to speak of for the United States. In fact, President Trump was criticizing that effort just yesterday when he was talking about this budget. All the trillions of dollars that we've wasted in the Middle East over the past 15, 16 years. And how that we need to spend those trillions now at home. Here's what he said just yesterday, clip 3.
But we have to rebuild our infrastructure. You know, I said this morning, as of a couple of months ago, we have spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. $7 trillion. What a mistake. But it is what it is. This is what I took over. And we're trying to build roads and bridges and fix bridges that are falling down. And we have a hard time getting the money. It's crazy. But think of that. As of a couple of months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East. And the Middle East is far worse now than it was 17 years ago when they went in. And not so intelligently, I have to say, went in. I'm being nice. So it's a very sad thing. The budget was recently passed. And the reason it was passed is because of our military. Our military was totally depleted, and we will have a military like we've never had before. We're going to have an incredible military.
That's President Trump speaking yesterday about this new budget and all the wasted trillions that went into the Middle East. And, you know, he's right about that. But the Bible prophesies that your strength would be spent in vain. That's what God says about the United States in these latter days. The Middle East is worse now than it was 17 years ago. I mean, who can disagree with that? But really, what we should point out more specifically is that the United States doesn't have anything to show for it. All of those trillions of dollars. And what I can tell you here today is that if we start redirecting the trillions to all of these spending programs at home, again, we'll get a few years down the road and we won't have anything to show for it because God's not blessing our nations. It says in the New York Times piece, yet for all the talk of fiscal restraint, President Trump's budget also amounted to an institutional surrender to the free spending ways of Capitol Hill, which Mr. Mulvaney, that's Mick Mulvaney, he's the budget director for President Trump, which Mr. Mulvaney said had surprised the president and prompted him to refrain from even bothering to advocate deficit reduction. That's quite a statement. In other words, he comes into office or he's campaigning for president and he's campaigning on the promise of fiscal restraint. And then he gets in and sees the free spending ways of Capitol Hill. He's surprised by it and then thinks, well, I guess this is the way we do it. Then I'm not even going to bother advocating for a deficit reduction. I'm not even going to talk about it. What's the point? The strategy now is that, look, we get what we want because we're in charge. And then the Democrats say, okay, then, but we get what we want because you need 60 votes in the Senate anyway. And so that's what's happening. They call it a compromise. They call it bipartisanship. What it is a spending spree of epic proportions, something this world's never seen. And we're only able to sustain it because of deficit spending, because of borrowing, and because of printing money. That this was amazing too, quoting Mr. Mulvaney. I probably could have made it balance. I probably could have, he says, I probably could have balanced it on the sheets. Mr. Mulvaney says, a former anti-deficit absolutist. He said ruefully of his plan on Monday, but it would have taken funny numbers to do it. I guess this is the new conservatism. Look, we're not going to use funny numbers anymore. We're just going to tell you straight up. We're adding trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars to the deficit. I mean, all this talk about, fiscal restraint. Listen, I was for that until I got here and saw how they spend at Capitol Hill. So I'm not even going to bother advocating deficit reduction. I'm not even going to bother. The Times says here, Mr. Trump's plan could easily result in much larger federal deficits. Well, I should say, the administration made its calculations using assumptions about the United States economic trajectory that are more optimistic than the consensus among private sector forecasters or the assumptions used by other parts of the government. So this forecast, along with this $4.4 trillion budget proposal, it's based on this Pollyannish notion that the economy is just going to keep growing bigger and stronger with each passing year. The Trump administration is projecting that it's going to grow at 3.1% over the next 3 years. And the Federal Reserve is projecting 2.2%. So you come along and say, well, hey, it's not even going to be as bad as you think because we're going to grow so much. And even with this optimistic outlook, we're adding $1 trillion per year to the deficit. Even with this, what happens if it's not quite so rosy over the next few years? What happens if there's a downturn? How much longer is this sustainable? Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but look, this is breaking America. We had two programs last week, last Tuesday's show, The Wicked Borrows and Cannot Pay Back. That was from February 6th. You can find that at thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. We've also put together some material, just today, written material from that same program. Hopefully we'll have that posted at the website soon. But then last Friday's show, Republicans run up the debt, run up the deficit faster than President Obama. I mean, it's going up fast. And we're not even really in the midst of a costly war or a banking and mortgage crisis. As I say, what happens when there's more crises piling up? When we come back, we'll get into the moral breakdown, quite a few stories that we've been accumulating here in recent weeks on this subject. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
Thank you. Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Derek Hunter had a piece at Town Hall recently where he talked about the current political climate and how it grows out of what we as a culture have become. He says, while every generation undoubtedly had valid complaints about the pop culture of their time, there is no way, even in the era of bell bottoms and pet rocks, the popular culture at the time was as dumb as it is now. He does use a little bit of, or at least tries to be funny in certain spots here, but at the same time, some of these things I'm not even quite familiar with myself. But it's a pretty accurate portrayal of just how childish and immature our culture, our society has become. Isaiah 3 speaks of that. People are filming themselves eating laundry detergent and posting the videos online because being stupid for attention is now something people aspire to. I guess they're called Tide Pods, as we discussed in a meeting yesterday. And people are eating them. It's the Tide Pod Challenge on YouTube. He says later, speaking of stupid people posting videos online, there's YouTube celebrity Logan Paul. He posted a video of a Japanese man who'd hung himself and mocked, which was dumb. Then he posted a video of him telling his subscribers to engage in the Tide Pod Challenge and another of him using a taser on a dead rat. Okay, so you think, well, this is just some crazy lunatic. But later on in the piece, as Derek Hunter brings out, I mean, this is a fool, basically, who's raking in $1.2 million per month from ads embedded into his YouTube videos. $1.2 million because people love the videos. They're wildly popular. It says, not to be outdone, the news service Reuters actually published a piece wondering if there is a glass ceiling in dog shows. No, I'm not joking. Why? Because male dogs apparently win twice as often as female dogs, according to people with far too much time on their hands. And then there are liberals excited about the Black Panther movie. I love the Marvel movies. Each has been very entertaining, but some people are too excited, stupid excited. Why get worked up over a comic book movie? Because according to the liberal blog Salon, Black Panther is the first blockbuster format release featuring a black hero front and center. And Derek Hunter says, this is true if you ignore the scores of other blockbusters with a black hero front and center. That Salon would try to hijack something popular is not surprising. They need clicks. But people got upset when the movie got its first negative review. The reason for it is the reason for everything that doesn't go the way liberals want. Racism. You're a racist if you give it a bad review. Not to be outdone in the stupid, none other than the New York Times declared, part of the emotional and visual appeal of Black Panther lies in the fact that Wakanda has never been colonized. Hunter says, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the movie or the comic books on which it is based, Wakanda is a fictional African country, which would make not only colonization difficult, but a vacation fairly unlikely as well. He says, finally, all this is just the tip of the idiotic iceberg in the last couple of weeks. There's so much more out there, like the rabbi who wrote about how she thought Eve from the book of Genesis was the first victim in the Me Too movement, and the perp was God. How? According to her, here is a young, beautiful, intelligent, naked woman living in a state of grace. She's hungry, so she does the most natural thing in the world and eats a piece of fruit. For following her instincts, trusting herself, and nourishing her body, she's punished. Her punishment? She will never again feel safe in her nakedness. She will never again love her body. She will never again know her body as a place of sacred sovereignty. Hunter says, I don't claim to be a biblical scholar, but I'm fairly certain this rabbi isn't either. Finally, he says, maybe someday we'll return to a time when simply getting attention required actually doing something. And maybe one day we'll look back at this and laugh. But he says it's more likely that none of that will happen, that things will only get worse, that people like this are this country's future. See, he's right. I mean, you can laugh at some of these, these incidents, but he's right. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse. I've used this quote a number of times before from Forever Young, this book about just how immature our culture is, and how that we're in the final silly stages of this cultural disease. A new morality, the new morality, you could say, or the new American morality, as Joel Hilliker wrote a few weeks back. Where is it leading? The historian, Edward Gibbon, from the 1700s, I think, he wrote that the root cause of a societal collapse, at least with respect to the Roman Empire, it's the loss of civic virtue and individual morality. Gibbon believed that the laws of morality were as constant as the laws of mathematics. Was he right? Is it different today? A lot of people believe that it is. They think that, oh, we're just too modern, too sophisticated, too enlightened to ever collapse under the weight of what God defines as sin. I mean, who cares what God says is sin? That's what most conclude. But what if Gibbon was right? And what if the Bible is right? Look at just the dramatic change in so many people's views on morality in the United States, here in the UK. We've written about a number of these topics before: premarital sex, what the Bible defines as fornication. It's now not only seen as normal because most people engage in it, it's seen as moral. It's moral. I mean, it's so common that many abstinence-only programs have been replaced with programs that teach young people how to be safe once they become sexually active. Safe in quotes, you could add. I mean, if all of society is going along this course, then we've just got, as the educators or the parents or the authorities, we've just got to get on board with it and teach them about birth control and teach them how to avoid STDs. More than two-thirds of Americans now view divorce as morally acceptable. It's not just accepted, it's morally accepted. It's moral to divorce. A few months back, I referred to the Gallup poll. This was from 2017, about how 36% of Americans believe pornography is moral. It's the right thing to do. View a little bit of pornography. As I said, Joel Hilliker in that Trumpet.com piece, The New American Morality, it's a great little article talking about how inconsistent these moral laws are today and how they can also be very unforgiving. He said a while back, the new American morality says that all men are rapists and potential rapists and should be feared and contained. At the same time, it says that if one of these men believes he is a woman, that is truth, and we all need to play along. It is now moral to allow children to choose their gender from their earliest years. It is immoral to encourage them to conform to gender stereotypes, such as instilling in boys a duty to protect girls. You can't do that. That's immoral. But it's moral to let your little child decide, if he's a boy, to decide that he's a girl. let me just take you through a couple of verses that Mr. Hilliker referenced in that that short article. He said, just to finish with one quote, he said, "Fornication, an out-of-wedlock birth, moral, and woe to anyone who would try to stop it. Pornography, so ubiquitous that it's readily, regularly viewed, even by children, moral." That's moral. Same-sex marriage, moral. Heterosexual marriage, that might be okay as long as the man isn't the head of the family, which is a form of oppression and therefore immoral. So you get the idea. You can pretty much bet that if the Bible takes this position, the new morality is exactly the opposite. Isaiah 5 and verse 20. It says, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them who call evil good and good evil." This is where we are today. It's upside down. Verse 21 says, "Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." Human reasoning. We like to consider ourselves to be good. And so the more evil we become, the more we change the definitions. A little bit of moral relativism. And here's where we are. Isaiah 29 and verse 15 and 16. Let me just read this quickly. It says, "Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from God, and their works are in the dark, and they say, who sees us and who knows us? Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, he made me not? Or shall the thing framed say to him that framed it, he had no understanding? Woe unto them who turn things upside down." That's where we are today. Pornography, as I say, of all things, 36% who see it as not just normal, they see it as moral. It's morally accepted. It's so widespread now that you have some educators in America from high schools. There's an example in a New York Times piece that ran just the other week about schools in I believe it's the Massachusetts area, that are teaching young people about porn literacy, as they call it. 2 hours a week over a five-week period. They've pulled together 24 students to take part in this class. This is a class in high school. Maggie Jones wrote the piece at the New York Times just a few days ago, or maybe last week, I forget. But she says the class aims to make them savvier, more critical consumers of porn by examining how gender, sexuality, aggression, consent, race, queer sex, relationship, and body images are portrayed in porn. So that's American education, actually, in 2018. We're at a point where pornography is so ubiquitous that educators are now teaching children how to view it critically or responsibly. This so-called porn literacy course says it's grounded in the reality that most adolescents do see porn. The class takes the approach that teaching them to analyze its message is far more effective than simply wishing our children could live in a porn-free world. See, it's the same way that they caved in years ago, back in the 90s, with all the abstinence-only programs. Well, everybody does it, so now we've got to teach them how to have sex the right way. And now with pornography, of all things. We're in the midst of the Me Too movement. And now with pornography, of all things, you have the educators hopping on board and saying, well, everyone's doing it, so let's get in there and show them how to view it responsibly. My father in the No Freedom Without Law booklet, he talks about how pornography is the engine that runs the internet. I mean, it is ubiquitous. There's no getting around that. But this is man's solution. If it's ubiquitous, then just get in there and join in on the fun. That Maggie Jones piece, I mean, some of it you just can't really, it's hard to read. But you've got to get into some of it. We've got to protect our young people. We've got to protect our children. I mean, some of the most popular pornographic sites, they're pulling in something like 80 million visitors a day. 80 million a day. That's what the most popular site gets. I won't even tell you what the site is. More traffic than Pinterest, Tumblr, PayPal, all the big websites. They can't outperform pornography, not even close. Jones says here, the mainstream websites aren't verifying your age and your phone allows you to watch porn away from the scrutinizing eyes of adults. If you still have parental control filters, you probably have ways around them. But see, none of that, I mean, don't clamp down on any of those things. Let's talk about, well, if everyone's doing it, then let's just educate them about pornography. If you can't stop the children from watching it, you might as well join them or help them view it in a responsible way. It's just a complete and total surrender to the forces of evil. It's a complete and total surrender to Satan the devil. That's what it amounts to. So out come the sex educators, and they're creating a porn education website for parents. Here you go, parents. Here's what you can teach your children about pornography. It quotes one individual in this piece saying, we've given our children technology, so we need to teach them how to handle it. You know, you think about those social media creators. We talked about this story a few weeks back. Facebook and the like. I mean, they came out, they made this, and then it turned into this monster. And even they will tell you, it's gotten out of hand. It's now dangerous, and we don't even consume it ourselves. We don't even consume it. We don't have our children consume it. They have enough sense to know, look, if this is going in a bad direction, then just stay away from it. But with pornography, oh no, no common sense there. This is the new morality. Sit teenagers in front of the TV, show them explicit sex scenes, and then teach them about it. She interviews this gal in the New York Times piece about, well, you know, would you recommend this for your own children? And this educator says, I would recommend good sites to my daughters at age 15. See, there's some good pornographic sites, I guess. I would recommend good sites to my daughters at age 15 when I think they're mature enough. We're so curious to find out about sex. People have doubts and insecurities about themselves sexually. Is it okay that I like that or this? I think porn can be a good thing to have as an outlet. I'm not scared by explicit sex per se. I'm afraid of bad values. She's not scared of what an explicit sex scene might do to a 15-year-old. She's afraid of bad values. And what are those values? Well, like Mr. Hilliker said in his trumpet brief from a while back, they're very inconsistent, and they're also very unforgiving. You can't go against what society says is bad values. You've got to get on board with it. Back in September, the September 2017 issue of Wired magazine, journalist or author Sally Fallon, she wrote about bringing up her two sons in this porn culture, and she interviewed this author, Peggy Orenstein, who's currently working on a book about boys, sex, love, and porn. And Orenstein said to Fallon in this piece, the first thing I recognized when I started working on the new book was that the question to ask boys is not whether or if they watch porn. The question is, when was the first time they saw it? Okay, so everyone does it, they say. So we've got to start from that premise. Orenstein said this, "The biggest surprise for me as a parent has been how hard we now have to work to protect our kids' imaginations from predatory, addictive websites that want to sell things to them or sell them to advertisers. So you have to lay the groundwork to have conversations about what's real and what's not. Talk about how when you see a movie, there's violence, but the violence is totally unrealistic, rather. Porn is really only the extreme end of an issue. We know these things are fake. That's not the way two people really interact. Kids have to be able to contextualize, to deconstruct it, just like the need to do with in other forms of media. Because, yes, everyone is upset about porn, but the messages they get from garden variety media are just as influential, maybe more so. So it's all lumped together. And look, our job as educators or parents is to get in there and to try to help them understand what's real and what's unrealistic. Okay? Hand over the smartphone to your children. Just accept the fact that they're going to consume whatever they want, including pornography, but then make sure that they do it responsibly. And make sure that they understand what's fake and what's not fake. They're serious. These are educators who are serious about educating young people. I mean, I mentioned in the program a few weeks back, Matt Kessler, who wrote this piece at The Atlantic, December 2017, the environmental cost of internet porn. Environmental cost! Hear all of this pornographic filth. It's degrading women. It's objectifying women. It weakens the will of men. It robs them of true masculinity. It destroys marriages and families. It gives children a grotesque view of the God-ordained purposes for marriage and sex. And Kessler comes along and he's worried about pornography's carbon footprint. It's unbelievable. I mean, they're serious about this. Woe unto them, as Isaiah said, when they call evil good and good evil. That's what's really happening. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll conclude with a couple of clips from my father's recent program on the Key of David, God's Purposes of Sex. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
But if you look at educators and scientists and psychologists today, they talk about moral standards and all of that, but they believe in evolution. They do not know the origin and purposes of sex. They don't know the origin of marriage. They do not know. Well, it's very clear if you believe the Bible. But if you reject the Bible, well, you're just relying on human reasoning. And that's going to bring you disaster. That's good. That's what's bringing this world disaster. And our number one problem today is that of human survival, because we're relying on the human mind and not God's thinking.
That's my father from his Key of David program, December 15th, 2017, God's Purposes of Sex. You can get to that that video at thetrumpet.com under the videos link. Also, he's got an article, by the way, based on some of that information, The Beautiful Truth That Would Solve the Sex Scandals. That's in the March 2018 Trumpet that just came out. That, too, you can get to at thetrumpet.com. But here we are relying on human reasoning. And human reasoning, as he said there, it brings disaster. That's where this world is headed. In The Missing Dimension in Sex, one of our textbooks here at Armstrong College, Mr. Armstrong, of course, in that book, he goes through the fact that God created sex for purposes that are totally foreign to the animal kingdom, the plant life. And he says, but the world has continued in unhappy and wretched ignorance of these glorious and God-bestowed purposes. See, we just continue right on in ignorance, ignoring the laws of God, humanly reasoning our way through these new trends and developments. All of these appalling evils, everyone's doing it. So, well, let's get in there and try to put an educational stamp on it and make it seem modern and sophisticated. We're educating our youths, after all. We're progressing. We've evolved. We've come so far. We're just far removed from God, as far removed as ever. The prophet Isaiah says, the whole head is sick. That's Isaiah 1, 5 and 6. The whole head is sick. From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there's no soundness in it. Let's just conclude by looking through Ezekiel 24 here. You can read more about this chapter in my father's booklet. Ezekiel, the end time prophet, in that booklet, he says that Ezekiel 24 contains one of the Bible's strongest, most astonishing messages. I mean, it's addressed at God's people and at our nations, and it's for the last days. Ezekiel 24, 27 says, in that day shall your mouth be opened to him which is escaped, and you shall speak and be no more dumb, and you shall be a sign unto them, and they shall know that I am the Eternal. They're going to know at some point, our nations will know that God lives, that God reigns, that God is eternal. Now, backing up to verses 1 and 2, this is Ezekiel 24. The prophet says here, again in the ninth year, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Son of man, write you the name of the day, even the same day, the king of Babylon set himself against Jerusalem this same day. So God here is about to give Ezekiel this revelation, and it commemorated the day of the siege of Jerusalem, a terrible time of suffering and violence and captivity. And that time parallels the time we're heading into. Verse 3, it says, and utter a parable unto the rebellious house, and say to them, thus says the Eternal God, set it on a pot, and also pour water into it, gather the pieces thereof in it, even every good piece, the thigh and the shoulder, fill it with the choice bones, take the choice of the flock, and burn also the bones under it, and make it boil well, and let them seethe the bones of it therein. Wherefore, thus says the Eternal God, woe to the bloody city, to the pot whose scum is therein, and whose scum has not gone out of it. Bring it out, piece by piece. Let no lot fall upon it. What is God talking about here in this parable? He says to the prophet, Ezekiel the prophet, he says, look, take the fleshiest part of the meat and the strongest bones and burn them all. If you look at that word scum there in, I think, verse 6, it means rust. So God says our sin is like rust or scum or green corrosion. It's clinging to our people. It's something that you can't get rid of unless there's a total purge, unless you burn it off. Verse 7 says, for her blood is in the midst of her. She has set upon the top of a rock. She poured it not upon the ground to cover it with dust. Again, God's talking about the sins of Israel, the sins of our nations. The people just putting their sins out there on top of a rock or on top of a mountain and declaring it. Declaring your sin as Sodom, just like it says in Isaiah 3. Showing the whole world just how vile and depraved we are on YouTube with pornography. You name it. And of course, we do all of this saying that, well, it's freedom. It's free speech. We have absolute freedom in this land to do whatever. And look at what we're doing with those freedoms. Look at what we're putting on display. Look at what we're broadcasting to the world. God's addressing nations here who've had a history with him. And he's saying, look, I meant for you to put the right example on display. Instead, you're out there spreading all this filth right around the world. And God calls it what it is. It's rust and corrosion. And what does he do? How does he deal with it? Verse 8 says that it might cause fury to come up and take vengeance. I have set her blood upon the top of a rock, that it should not be covered. Therefore, thus says the eternal God, woe to the bloody city. I will even make the pile for fire great. It's a sobering prophecy. But you can see why it has to be this way. Israel, the nations of Israel in these latter days, they take the greatest imaginable evils, and then they just spew it all over the earth, right into the minds of everyone, anyone and everyone that we can reach, even into the lives and minds of our own children, sitting our children down in front of pornographic videos. So God says, look, I'll punish you in the same way that you've been broadcasting abroad. I'm going to trumpet and broadcast your punishment in front of everyone. I'm going to publicize it. I'll put it out there where the whole world will see it. Verse 10 says, heap on wood, kindle, and fire. Consume the flesh and spice it well, and let the bones be burned. Then set it, that's speaking of the pot, set it empty upon the coals thereof, that the brass of it may be hot and may burn, and that the filthiness of it may be molten in it, that the scum of it may be consumed. So after all of this burning, God says, now set the pot on the fire and burn the pot, burn the scum, burn the rust. Some sobering words. As my father brings out in the Ezekiel booklet, God's talking about a despicable people and explaining why the tribulation and the day of the Lord. This is why the tribulation and the day of the Lord are coming. It's to turn people to their God, just like it says at the last part of the chapter, so that they might know that I am the Eternal. Are we really the greatest, speaking of America, is it the greatest nation on this earth? Just look at what we're descending into. Look at these sins that have just been etched into our hearts. as the prophet Jeremiah said in chapter 17, just carved into our hearts. And here Ezekiel says it's like rust. It's like corrosion on a pot. And God's so disgusted, he says, just burn all of it. Just melt it all down. Let's get a fresh start here. I mean, look at how far removed we are from the God-ordained purposes for sex, for marriage and sex and family. Such a beauty. As I was telling my students this morning in Principles of Living, there's so much that we can take away from God's creation. Just like Paul said in Romans 1 and verse 20, the creation reveals God. Even the way he created men and women, male and female, created he them, as it says in Genesis 1. God made the sex organs. He ordained family, marriage and family. And even like Mr. Armstrong covers in chapter 8 of The Missing Dimension in Sex, even the way he designed human beings. The woman, for instance, the menstruation process, and then menopause later in life. Things that you don't see in the animal kingdom. Why did he create it this way? Why did he make the female body that way? Why isn't there a rutting period like there is in the animal kingdom? It's because God intended for two marrieds, husband and wife, he intended for them to express love in marriage through sex. It's a beautiful, beautiful creation of God. And look at how much man, under the influence of the devil, the god of this world, has twisted and distorted that beautiful family vision. God is a family. God is the author of marriage and family. He designed sex for an incredible purpose, just like my father brought out in that Key of David program. Here's one final clip from that show, clip two.
Sex was created to bring a husband and wife together in love. That's the purpose of it. The main purpose in marriage is to have sex and bring those two people together so they have this wonderful relationship, and sex keeps it interesting, and they learn to love each other more and more and more and have children and are just thrilled to have children and have them, if they're directed God's way and taught God's way. It's one of the most miraculous and fantastic blessings on this earth. But that's not the way it is in most families. And it should be. It should be.
It should be, and it can be, if we educate ourselves in the knowledge of God. If we look to God for guidance and direction in all that we do, study Herbert Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex. Study it along with your Bible. Look into the Psalms where it talks about the human body being the most wonderful mechanism that God's created out of material substance. Use God's revelation. Use His truth. Apply this knowledge. And bring joy into your life, into your marriage, into your family, into the lives of your children. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, as always, to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.